Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, это Prevail. И ваш ведущий Грег Олье.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is the season finale of the Prevail podcast, episode 25. You know, when I started doing this in February, I would dutifully just write down S1E1, S1E2. And I thought to myself, God, I wonder how long like a season's going to be, because this isn't like a narrative podcast, right? It's just, I'm just talking to people every week. So I don't even know what that means, a season. And now I have the answer. A season is 25 episodes. You've got 25 weeks of great content, and I've delivered that. And I'm happy about it. I'm pleased with how this has gone. I've had some really great people on this show in this first half year. I'm grateful to all of them. I'm grateful to you for listening. And today's episode is really great. It's like a treat because my good friend Duke Haney is here. Duke is, first of all, he's one of my favorite people. He is a writer. He wrote a novel called Banned for Life, which we'll talk about in the podcast, which is just a fantastic, fantastic book that probably you haven't read, and I encourage you to go check out. He was an actor. He's a photographer. He's a screenwriter. He's just an artistic guy, really smart, fun to listen to. And I recorded this with him months ago. I think it was in March that we recorded this. And I wasn't sure when I would run it, you know, because it's a departure sort of episode. Because in the first part, we talk about Trump and the election. And I think people will respond to this or identify with it, because Duke is a guy who was not overtly political and kind of became very political when Trump won in 2016. So we talk about that and his story and his sort of awakening during that 4-year period of time. He's also from Charlottesville, Virginia. That's where he grew up. So we talk a little bit about Charlottesville and how that word has been associated with the alt-right in this horrible way. And then the second part of the podcast, it's almost like a Sunday Pages. If you read my Prevail Substack, you know, on Sunday I run literary stuff. I run short stories, I run poems, songs, song lyrics, things like that. And he and I talk about, writing and his career, which is kind of fun and interesting and eclectic. I mean, he was living in Serbia. He was making movies with Roger Corman, all kinds of stuff. He has a lot of funny stories, and he's just an interesting guy to talk to. So I wasn't sure when this would run. And the answer is, it's the season finale. That's when it's going to run. So again, this is episode 25. We're going to have 2 weeks where I'm going to do reruns. I'm going to rerun a couple of episodes that ran early on in the broadcast. And then we will be back on the 27th of August. That'll be the next new podcast. The beginning of season two is what it's going to be. It's going to be the beginning of season two of the Prevail podcast. I want to just thank everybody for listening. It's such an honor and privilege and kind of a mind blow to just have launched this thing almost in a very soft opening sort of way and see the numbers grow and know that people are out there listening. And it really means a lot to me. I'm so happy that it's finding an audience. I'm really grateful for all the guests that have come on, because I've had some really interesting conversations and I've learned a lot from my guests these past 25 weeks. And I just want to say a general thank you to all of them. And anybody that reads my Substack, that subscribes there, thank you for doing that. That's always appreciated. You can go check that out. It's just gregoliar.com. You know, there's lots of good stuff on there on the archive as well. So we're going to be right back with Duke Haney. Meantime, everybody, please be safe. Wear your masks. Be careful. And I want everybody to enjoy the rest of August, but I especially want everybody to just be safe and smart. Let's stop the spread. Let's get this thing under control so we can, you know, resume normalcy. All right. Do I have anything else to add? Any words of wisdom? I do not. I do not have any words of wisdom for you other than thanks again. And we'll be right back with my friend, Duke Haney.
Time to go home now. I've got an aching head. Chills and high fever. I may soon be dead. Wish I had listened. I guess the doctors were right. Fuck Eric Clapton. I'm on a ventilator tonight. Fuck Eric Clapton.
Okay, I'm here with my dear friend, Duke Haney, who is, in addition to a dear friend of mine, one of the best writers I know. And I'm not saying that to be hyperbolic here. I have your books here in front of me, Banned for Life, which, as you know, I love. Great novel. And then you have two essay collections of nonfiction. You've got Subversia, and you've got Death Valley Superstars. And I encourage everybody to go check those out. Now, you and I have not actually spoken on the phone since you called me on election night, late on the East Coast on election night, and you were nervous, and I talked you off the ledge. So my first question is, how are you feeling now? Do you feel any better?
Oh God, a lot better. Actually, one of the reasons that I was nervous about doing this with you today is that I have to confess that I am not following current events as closely as I did for 5 years, roughly, from when Trump entered the fray. So I feel so relieved that I don't have to white knuckle my way to the news every day. So I'm afraid I'm not up to speed on an awful lot that's going on.
That's fine. And that's to be expected. I mean, what I want to talk about the Trump years anyway with you, because something that I thought was interesting, you and I met on a website called The Nervous Breakdown, which was a sort of literary place where we all went, and lots of different writers had access or were able to post things. And then we would all comment on each other's posts, and it became this lively
community, writers community. It was almost like an MFA that we got without having to pay for, right? And at that time, writing about politics on that site, I mean, just nobody ever did it. It wasn't anything that was popular or normal. And you struck me as somebody who wasn't political at all. You know, it's certainly not in any kind of quote unquote woke sort of way. And then when Trump came along, it was like you were animated, like something activated inside you and you became this completely other person. Now, I remember you saying early on that you thought that Trump would win. So why did you say that? What made you think that early on? This was long before November.
Well, I first of all, I watched him take down a whole host of Republican candidates one by one. I noticed that he seemed to dominate the debates. Everybody was talking about Trump. The energy was sort of, I hate that word, energy, unless it's literally applying to energy. but he seemed to be sucking up all the oxygen in every room that he inhabited. And I remember talking to my brother on the phone. This would have been in the spring of 2016. And I remember that he said to me at the time that he was not a Trump supporter, but quote unquote, Trump is saying a lot of things that need to be said. And then it came to my attention that he was in fact a Trump supporter. That was around June or July. And I haven't talked to him since.
Wow. Okay.
He and I don't talk to this day because he voted for Trump and his wife voted for Trump. And actually probably almost everybody in my family voted for Trump, except my mom. She had succumbed to Fox News and began to identify herself prior to 2016 for the first time as conservative. She used to say to me when I was a kid that she didn't vote for the person, or she voted for the person, not for the party. And I took that to heart. And then suddenly she was calling herself a conservative, which horrified me. I remember having a conversation with her on the phone around the time that I learned my brother was a Trump supporter. And she was going through her misgivings about Hillary. And I said, but Mom, you know, Hillary is the best we've got. And she said, well, I have to admit, I think you're right. And I made her sound like Ronald Reagan there. A little bit sounded like Ronald Reagan to me a little bit. And she became a Hillary supporter. So I was happy that I converted my mom, although I did get from her the, you know, but what about her emails? We went through a long thing about her emails. And she said, well, if I had a job like that, and they told me not to use a certain server, I wouldn't use a server. Like, Mom, it's just emails, for Christ's sake. It's like she said, it's a nothing burger. And I was raising money on the phone for her in 2016. I mean, that was my job at the time. I was actually working a job that was barely, you know, paying minimum wage, but I was raising money for her and for other other Democratic candidates, for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Senatorial Campaign Committee, so I have to say that I started that election cycle not a fan of Hillary's. I had misgivings about her. Left over from her husband's presidency, because as you know, I lived in the former Yugoslavia, which was bombed by the Clinton administration. And I was not a fan of the Clinton administration's foreign policy. But as the campaign went on, I began to separate her, you know, more and more from her husband, which I realized I had never done. And I you know, took her on her own terms and was a very enthusiastic supporter, I have to say, by the end.
So. That's how she is. You know, she gets in there and then you realize, oh, this, you know, she's actually quite good. And it's an interesting point about separating them, because she's been basically targeted by Republican dirty ops for, what, 35 years now, and has suffered from her husband's stuff and her own, and being a woman and all this other kind of stuff. It's been pretty, you know, ghastly, really. Now, did your brother vote for Trump again in 2020 or just in 2016, or do you not know?
My understanding is that he voted for Biden in the last election. This is just via my mom. I don't really get into the political thing with my dad too much, because I'm telling you, every minute that you're in that house, if he isn't watching a ball game, he's watching Fox or a hunting or fishing show. But Fox is on all the time there. And you remember that I vowed never to speak to anybody who had voted for Trump after he was declared the winner. And I held to that. I broke with some people, in addition to my brother. It was quite painful in some cases.
I think a lot of people did. I think listening to this, people will nod and they'll say, oh yeah, my parents, my brother, people get lost, especially to Fox News. And if you're watching Fox News all the time, I mean, it's at this point, it's almost the same as watching RT in Russia. They show the same damn video clips. It's really kind of crazy. After the election, you were on Facebook and you were having kind of a meltdown, I think, in an amusing way. I mean, we were all having our own meltdowns, but I remember one thing you said, because you, I don't know how you had so many Trump people that were your friends on Facebook to begin with, but you said to one person, enjoy your king. And I think that was one of the best things anyone wrote at the time. And it really did turn out to be pretty prophetic, because that's what he certainly tried to make himself into. And these people that adore him, almost, it is kind of an adoration reminiscent of a monarchy and less of a presidency.
Well, let me tell you what happened that night. I mean, I have been keeping my eye on the polls. I mean, I would check the polls 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times a day during the 2016 election cycle. And whenever I saw a poll that saw him ahead, you know, I would go into a deep depression. And but everybody around me seemed to think that Hillary would win. And there were moments when I thought maybe, or even probably, she would prevail. Aha, little plug there, Greg. And then, of course, the Comey letter came out, or whatever message or whatever. And I remember that that weekend, it was around Halloween, I went out to an all-night horror-thon at this theater out in Santa Monica, and I didn't have a way back. And so everybody I had gone with, they all left, you know, at like 3-4 in the morning. And I stayed all the way through the entire thing, and staggered out of the theater at like 8 in the morning. It was drizzling. And I was waiting for the bus to take me all the way back to Echo Park. There's quite a distance between Santa Monica and Echo Park. And I was looking at my phone at the polls, and the polls are really reflecting the impact of the Comey letter. And I called a friend of mine, and I said, you know, I'm standing here at the bus stop, and I just saw these polls, and there's just no, Trump is going to win. And he didn't believe it. He said, well, even if he gets in, I mean, you know, they'll remove him really quickly, which is the kind of rationalization that I heard all over the place.
Sure. Yeah, I thought so, too.
Well, a lot of people thought that. Anyway, I tried to be optimistic. And on election night, I was afraid to look at the returns. And then I did a little bit, and they were not looking good. And I was like, okay, I am going to be institutionalized, have to be institutionalized if I sit around here and watch this all night. And so I'm going to go to the New Beverly Theater, which is owned by Quentin Tarantino. They're showing a double feature, election night double feature. It's a revival house. They were showing The Candidate with Robert Redford and Shampoo with Warren Beatty, which is all set on election day 1968, which Nixon won. For those of you who don't know. I was careful not to look at my phone all the way there. And I go in, the first movie was Shampoo, and I walked out into the lobby at intermission, and I saw everybody was sort of like looking down at their phones. Jumulence anywhere. I mean, I could just tell that the news must not be good, you know. And somebody came up to me that I knew, and I was like, "Do not talk to me. I do not want to know. Please do not tell me." I went back into the theater, and they were actually they had on the speakers, rather than playing like a 1970s soundtrack album the way that they would ordinarily at that theater, they were actually they had the election results being played inside the theater, and I could hear that, you know, Indiana is going, you know, and all this, and I was like, oh God. I sat all the way through that second film. I could barely pay attention to it. I was just sitting there just feeling terrible. I was actually plotting like the next few weeks. I thought, okay, this movie's over. I'm going to go home. I am going to go right to bed. I'm not going to look at my phone. I am not going to look at television. I'm not going to talk to anybody for like days, because I have to just mentally prepare myself for this. I have to, you know, it's a step onto a new planet. I have to kind of prepare myself to inhabit this new planet. So the movie's over, and I practically run to the lobby. Once again, people are standing outside the theater, like looking at their phones. You know, people look sort of gray faced. But I still haven't heard it officially. And I'm like, okay, I'm good. And I walk around the corner, and I happen to pass this bar. The bar has closed. The lights are all off, but the TV is on up above the bar. And I guess these are the employees. They're all standing, these silhouettes with their backs turned to me. They're all looking up at the TV. And there on the screen is Donald Trump acknowledging his victory. And at the bottom of the screen, I see Hillary Clinton has called Trump to concede. This is now, I don't know, around midnight or so. And so I immediately took up my phone, and I went on Facebook, and I wrote this thing in all caps. And you'll remember this. And I was like, if you voted for this guy, do not ever talk to me again. Don't ever talk to me. You're dead to me. And immediately, I get some like buttons, and people are popping in. And then this one woman I know who works in the film industry, who is also a born again Christian, comes in, and she starts saying, I voted for him, and how dare you say this, and this kind of thing. And then this other friend of mine, whom I've never met, he starts bickering with her. And then finally I waded in and I said, her name was Chris. And I said, Chris, just unfriend me now because I'm going to do it when I get home anyway. And then I think she and I had one more exchange, and that was when I wrote, enjoy your king.
It's really so perfect. Like it's succinct and it's every word is meaningful. Every word is meaningful. Enjoy, you know, the sort of almost ironical way, and your king rather than mine, and then king, and yeah, it's really good. It's good stuff. That was a brutal night. I mean, it really was, and I think everybody was feeling it 4 years later, when we couldn't get the catharsis right away, even when we knew that Arizona was going to win, and we knew that all the ballots were coming in, and all this kind of stuff. Just watching the sea of red on the screen was traumatizing. It was I knew that Biden was going to win, but it was traumatizing to watch that, and. They waited so damn long. They waited so long to announce. But when they announced.
We were told to expect this, Rick. We were told to expect this.
I wrote a thing saying to expect it.
I know. I mean, we all knew this was going to happen. And yet on that night, I had PTSD like so many of us do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you were one of about three people I called, actually. I mean, I not only was I on the ledge, I mean, I had, you know, 1 foot, you know, dangling out into space. And somebody else who said to me, look, he's going to win one of these, all he has to take is one battleground state. It's going to be Michigan or Wisconsin or one of them, you know, that's all he has to have. I was like, okay, I feel a little bit better now. It was a delayed response. And then of course, you know, on the day that Biden was declared, I marched right down to the corner of Sunset Boulevard and Echo Park Avenue. Actually, I took some pictures that you ended up using.
Yeah.
I had a mask on then, but then a friend of mine was like, hey, we're right up the street, we're at a bar, come up here, yoo-hoo. So I went up there, and the next thing I know, I'm like snorting cocaine at this guy's house, and nobody's wearing a mask. And then it turned out, then like a day later, I hear, Duke, you better go get tested for COVID. Somebody who was there that night has got it.
Oh, Christ.
So I let my guard down one time.
You didn't get it. You didn't get it, did you?
No, I didn't. No, no. Nobody was around. I just walked through the room with him, and he was like working out on his Nautilus machine or something. He just married a woman from Belarus or something, and apparently she's in tip-top shape, and so he feels he must be in tip-top shape also. And so he was, you know, working out on this Nautilus machine, and turned out that he had COVID.
Oh, God. No, I remember the Stefan, you know, my wife and Milo stayed up, my 14-year-old stayed up almost all night watching the returns. And I think it was the first night that they did that. They finally went to bed at 4 or 5 in the morning. They had been watching. Milo watched the whole thing. He was riveted by it. And I woke up early. The TV was still on, but everybody was asleep. And as I walked, it was probably 5:30, 5:45 in the morning. As I walked past the TV into the kitchen, Michigan turned blue on the screen. Mm-hmm. And I can't even tell you, all of my anxiety just washed right out of my body. Like it just flew away because, you know, I knew he was going to win, but I still wanted the certainty of it, you know. And since then, I've been all right. I mean, there's still, you know, God, there's so many bad things to unpack. But I wanted to ask you, too, about Charlottesville. And what your response was to that when it happened, because you are from Charlottesville. That's your hometown.
I did not like Charlottesville very much growing up there. It was fine up until, you know, I hit puberty, and suddenly I became aware of class. Which is something that I had, you know, practically no understanding of up until that time. And we talk a lot about race in this country, but we don't talk about class much. There were definite class lines there. And I suddenly discovered that I was born on the wrong side of the class line. And So I always felt inferior growing up there. I just, you know, I didn't really fit in with those who were of my class, and I was excluded from really from hanging out with people who were, you know, more on my wavelength, just because they had parents who were academics and that sort of thing. I mean, a lot of their parents, the parents of those kids, were associated with the University of Virginia. You know, they were academics and that kind of thing. So I was very eager to get away from Charlottesville, and it's always a little funny for me to think of it as my hometown. When I went back to Virginia, I tended not to go into town. My parents both grew up on farms outside of Charlottesville, and I would just hang out on my dad's farm or go to my grandmother's farm. It was nevertheless, you know, what can I say? It was horrifying to see these Nazis marching around with their, you know, tiki torches around the university. The university is really quite beautiful, I have to say.
Sure.
It's beautifully designed. I mean, I it was the only place in town really to go when I was a kid. I mean, you know, like as a teenager, when I would skip school, I would go to the university because there were little places to hang out there, you know, and there would be screenings of I mean, like I saw Let It Be in A Hard Day's Night for the first time at the university. They screened it at, you know, they had some sort of film society or something like that. So I went over there for that. I used to rush fraternities when I was like 16, 17 years old. I mean, there was nothing else to do really in town, you know. I mean, those were the parties. You know, you went there because, you could hang out and pass yourself off as a college student or try to. So it was horrific, and I have a brother who is actually a lieutenant with the Charlottesville Police Department, and I asked him, you know, about that day. You know, he was conscripted. I mean, ordinarily he just sort of, you know, works a day job, it was as bad as it looked, and
yeah.
It's a little strange to you know, to think that that's what Charlottesville now denotes, I guess, in people's mind. I mean, that's, you know, that's the, you mentioned Charlottesville, and that's what people think of immediately. They don't think of Thomas Jefferson. They don't think of, you know, that's what they think of.
Yeah, no, it's crazy, and it could have happened anywhere. I mean, I think that. There are people like that everywhere in this country. I mean, I live in upstate New York in a very, very blue part of upstate New York. I live near Woodstock, Woodstock is exactly what you expect Woodstock to be in terms of how people vote and stuff like that. It's all, you know, poetesses and things. But even here, I mean, there's Trump flags and this and that. Shit, my car was on the street in front of my house, and somebody put a Trump bumper sticker over the Biden-Harris sticker on my car, right in front of my house. I didn't even see it. My wife came home, she was furious and tore it off. But I mean, that's like kind of a violation. And again, this is a pretty liberal hotbed, but you know, that element of things is everywhere. Now, I want to ask a little bit about your background, because you have an interesting background in terms of your contribution to cinema and your writing and just where you've lived and stuff like that. So you were in Yugoslavia. How did that come about? How did you wind up there? Because you were acting, right, in a movie? Is that how you wound up there? I can't remember.
Yeah. I moved to New York at 18 to study acting. And you know, did my first feature film, like, you know, almost immediately. I mean, then I didn't really work for a long time. But I did, you know, a lot of off Broadway fringe theater, and studied with, you know, great teachers, Montgomery Clift's, former personal coach, Mira Rostova, Frank Corsaro, who, became the artistic director of the Actors Studio after Lee Strasberg died. And, you know, then I was cast over the phone, in Brooklyn while I was coming down from an acid trip. It's true.
I know.
I was cast in a film, produced by, Roger Corman, directed by the guy who written After Hours for, Martin Scorsese. I had been in this guy's student film at NYU, and he said, if you can get on the plane tomorrow, you know, you have the part. So, you know, I got on the plane the next day, and then I ended up in LA, and there was no screenplay for the movie, and although the person who hired me was a writer, he was prohibited from taking a credit for anything he wrote for this movie by the Writers Guild, because he was a member of the guild. And so he and I were kind of collaborating in the script, and then I took over the writing completely, because, you know, he couldn't take a credit for it anyway. And then I was talked into putting my name on the script. I didn't want to do it because I was afraid people would hire me as a writer and not as an actor, which is exactly what did happen. And then, you know, somebody recommended me at Corman for the Friday the 13th, the latest Friday the 13th sequel. I was hired for that. I was doing another movie for Roger. And so I just moved out to LA. Roger sent me to Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Then it was Yugoslavia, the following year, to star in a movie over there. It was the worst movie I've ever done, and that's saying a lot. The director was a complete madman. He drove me crazy. I began to have panic attacks and developed full-blown panic disorder. And I think had that not happened, I might have been very successful, but I came back kind of a basket case. And I didn't handle it well. I mean, if you have a panic attack, you just have to sort of ignore it and sort of just get on with life. But you can't do what I did, which is sort of fall down the rabbit hole of self-analysis, because you'll just tie yourself up in knots, which is what I did. And so I just sort of kept working, you know, as an actor and as a screenwriter, more as the latter. I mean, I didn't have an agent for most of it. I mean, people would just recommend me and call me up, and, you know, somebody would call me up and say, hey, blah, 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 recommended you. I want to, you know, do a movie about, you know, I don't know, polka dot wearing Venetians invading Venice Beach. You know, you want to meet about that? Sure. Yeah. You know, I never wanted to return to Belgrade, because I associated it with the panic attacks I'd had there. But I thought it would be good for me to go back. So there was a film company over there looking for an American actor, and I was recommended by a Serb living here, Srđan Dragovic, who directed a couple of really good movies. And so I went over there to do a movie over there again, you know, and that time I really fell in love with it. You know, I had a kind of a crew of friends, and we were doing a lot of drugs, and I had an idea for a novel while I was over there, and I just decided to, you know, to move back to write the novel over there, because you know, it was so cheap to live there. So I sublet my place. I mean, my rent there was only like $200 a month or something like that. You
know? This is in Belgrade?
Mm-hmm.
What year was it? What year? This is Banned for Life, right? What year did you start mm-hmm. writing that?
I started trying to write it in 2000, and it took me about a year or two to find the beginning. And I've gone through the similar process with the novel I'm trying. Well, I'm trying to start now. I think I finally got the beginning. It's taken me about a year to find the beginning. Actually 2 years, but that's because last summer I got diverted from a novel by a nonfiction book that I'll probably end up writing. I mean, I just fell down. I just began to research this thing like crazy. And because everybody who would know anything about the story is going to die at any second. I mean, they would all be, you know, elderly.
Right.
And so I just had to try to track them all down and interview them right now before they all, you know, die. And so I abandoned the novel, and now I've sort of gone back to it. I mean, paradoxically, you know, pursuing this nonfiction story actually kind of helped me to find the beginning of the novel. But then they're both set sort of in the same period and everything.
Actually, I find that happens. You know, sometimes it's good to take a little break, let it sit for a while. You come back to it, and then you sort of see things you didn't see before.
Right. Exactly. Well, yeah. I mean, I actually was researching the novel when I stumbled onto this nonfiction story. So, but anyway, yeah, with Banned for Life, I finally found the beginning. Right around the time of 9/11, actually. And then, you know, of course, 9/11 shocked me out of. I couldn't write for a while, and then I just it was at that point that I decided I'm just gonna go over to Belgrade and live over there, and then I had to find my way back into it again and everything. But
it turned out really well. This is a great book, and as you know, I've been an evangelical for this book since I first read it, because it's one of those things where everybody's on this nervous breakdown site and people's books are coming out, and you sort of buy everybody's book almost as a mitzvah, you know, just to be nice. And so I'm like, oh, okay, I like what he's writing here. Let's try this. And then, you know, I'm completely transfixed by it. And everybody has the same reaction that I give it to. My wife read it. She loved it. Other people that I've given it to have really loved it. So, I can't believe how long it's been since these books came out. You know,
no, it's kind of amazing. Yeah. That book took me a long time because I just had a lot of, working on screenplays. I really developed a lot of bad writing habits. And so I ended up just taking a long time to kind of try to shape every sentence and to try to weed out all the, you know, the cheap stuff. I mean, I really tried to get in there and really hone in on the characters, and, you know, would they do this and would they do that? Only to have somebody tell me a long time later, like about the climax, you know, of the book, or one of them anyway, was like, Jason would never have done that. He would never have done. He would. And I was like, what are you talking? He's my character. I mean, what do you mean he wouldn't have done that? I would have done it. Thank you for, you know, I really appreciate all the evangelical work. I can't quite find the word I want to say.
Is that the right word? It's not the right word. It's proselytize. So that's not the right word either. I don't know. I'm just a big fan of the book. And you write also these great essays about pop culture. But I think sometimes when I read that, oh, this person writes about pop culture, what that usually translates into is somebody's online writing about the new Avengers movie or something. And that's dull. But you take generally subjects that are older, that are almost forgotten about, and reanimate them. That seems to be something I would say that you do, like movie stars from a bygone era and stuff like that. You know, certainly Death Valley Superstars, there's a lot of pieces like that in there. What's your favorite, do you think, of these sort of pop cultural pieces that you've done? Which ones?
I should say, thank you. I'm sorry, I cut you off. I see more and more of that, by the way, people cutting each other off in modern communications. I want to just say about the thing about writing about old movie stars. I mean, it's not like I'm writing about, you know, people. I don't really write much about Golden Age stuff. I don't write about, you know, Cary Grant or Gene Harlow or, you know, anyone like that. You know, I'm not really all that interested in that kind of stuff. I'm interested more, my interest in movies, I'm very interested in the, in sort of the silent era in a way. And then I my interest is reawakened. I mean, significantly reawakened with film noir. And then I become very, very interested in movies with the advent of method acting with Brando, Clifton, people like that. And I'm very interested in the 1960s and the early 70s anyway. And so a lot of Death Valley Superstars is really focused on that era. And the nonfiction story I'm pursuing now is about a little known actor, really little known actor, who got involved in some clandestine activity, let's say. So I seem to gravitate toward, I'm rather embarrassed to say, toward people who die young.
No.
I tend to eulogize. I think that sort of is my forte. I tend to sort of, I'm really big on eulogy, I guess. And I'm interested in people who just led colorful lives. I mean, in Death Valley Superstars, I write about Mark Breschette, the star of Zabriskie Point. I mean, he joined a cult and robbed a bank. That's kind of interesting. Sean Flynn, who was the son of Errol Flynn, became a photojournalist, disappeared during the Vietnam War, was killed almost certainly by the Khmer Rouge, but nobody really knows how. People like that. I would say that I don't know that I really have a single favorite piece in that, but I would say that there's a piece in there about Christopher Jones, who was considered sort of the next James Dean of the late 60s. I think that's maybe the most moving piece in the book, I think, because I became somewhat close to a person who was very close to him in her final months. And that was the focus of the piece. And that was a year when a number of people died. So I write a little bit about them in the piece. I mean, it began with him dying and a number of people followed. That piece is called Catch Me. I never thought I would write nonfiction, you know, that was never my aspiration. I began to write it.
Hey, yeah. Me neither. Look at me now. Yeah.
I know. There you go.
It's, I don't know. In some ways it's more fun and it cuts to the heart of things. Cause we're still, I think when I write about anything that's happening and certainly when you do, it's yes, the thing that we're writing about is something that happened and is real and isn't something invented, but the way that we're approaching it, because it comes from our own perception and our own voice, I don't know, there's still an originality to it. It's still creative. That's what I'm getting at. There's still a creative aspect to it, which is what ultimately what I want to be doing. You know, I want to be creative in what I'm working on. And creativity, as you know, takes many forms. You're a guy, you're an actor, you're a really good photographer, you're an excellent novelist, you write these essays, and you wrote the damn screenplay for Friday the 13th, part what, 7?
Yeah,
was it?
I know. Yeah, it's a weird thing to be known for that.
I know you hate that. Duke hates this. He's very embarrassed by this, but
No, I accept it now. I don't care anymore. I guess that's one of the things about getting older is that they always say that you don't give a damn about things you get older. And I guess that, you know, you just don't have time to give a damn about anything. It was a weird thing to fall into my lap. I mean, I was an art house guy. I mean, I was, you know, going to go see Godard and Antonioni movies, you know, with the Bleecker Street Cinema, you know, that kind of thing. I was the last person. I would ever have thought would write a Friday the 13th movie, you know, but I got the job and it paid 30 grand and, you know, that covered my moving expenses from New York to LA and then some, you know. It's just this kind of silly thing. But, you know, I think that you that's the thing with fame. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, that I that writing that thing makes me famous. Certainly, writing books will make practically nobody famous in this day and age. But you know, it's just weird how you can be singled out for celebrity by some odd thing that just happened to you. So, you know, you can be singled out for just something that has so little to do with you in a way.
It's true. Or go backwards into something that, you know, Michael Jordan just wanted to be a professional baseball player. So maybe we get what we want, but not quite the thing that we want. So
well, we get what we need. I don't know
if we try sometimes. Yeah. I think Mick Jagger is an underrated writer of lyrics. I just want to say, and I'm not a Stones fan by any stretch, but I think he's actually pretty good at writing lyrics, better than some of the other of his contemporaries. So,
yeah, I think so. I don't like the, you know, Sympathy for the Devil. I mean, I just think it's a little stupid, but I mean, you know, I mean, what is this, you know, hope you guessed my name. Well, I mean, what are you, come on now. I mean, I guessed it, right? It's in the title, for God's sake. but generally, I think you're right. I think he is pretty good, actually. He's I think he's better than, you know, really, I don't think, you know, we've talked about this before. I don't think that the Beatles were always necessarily particularly good lyricists.
No,
there's a lot
often,
of Moon and June.
You know? They're often awful, actually. Yeah. They're secretly sneaky bad a lot of the time. Mm. But I see the girls walk by dressed in their summer clothes. I have to turn my head until my darkness goes. That's good. That's a good lyric. There's good lyrics. He writes good lyrics. So, all right, we're gonna wind this down because this is what happens with these things. We get talking, and then the next thing you know, all this time goes by. I wanna end on this. What are you reading now? What do you recommend? What should we be consuming, watching, reading, listening to?
Well, thank you for asking me. I'm reading. I think maybe 20 books all at once. A lot of them. A lot of my reading, unfortunately, is for research. So, for example, I'm writing a book, that was a Freudian slip, reading a book called Orange Sunshine, which is about a drug trafficking group from the 1960s and 70s called the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, who operated out of Orange County, of all places, conservative Orange County. Mm-hmm. So that's for research. I'm reading another one of the people I interviewed for my current project is, I think he may be the greatest person I've ever met, although we haven't met physically yet. His name is Doug Peacock. He lives in remote Montana. Not like the Unabomber. He has a wife who's actually very attractive. I think she might run a bookstore up there. Doug was in the Vietnam War, and it had to do with the reason I got in touch with him. He came back from the war traumatized, like so many veterans, and his solution was to go into the wilderness where he encountered a grizzly bear. Encountering this grizzly bear in the wild meant that he could not have any Vietnam flashbacks at that moment. I mean, all I could think about was the fact that there was a grizzly bear, like, you know, 10 feet away from him. This encounter just changed his life. He went into the wild and began to study grizzly bears, became sort of a lay grizzly bear expert. He was also a lay physician because he was a medic with the Green Berets. He was a Green Beret, you know. He told me that, you know, he became a medic because it was like becoming a doctor without all the bullshit. That's what he put it to me. But he became very close with Edward Abbey, who immortalized him as one of the Monkey Wrench Gang. So Doug is kind of legendary among environmental activists. He just sent me, gosh, I mean, you're right here. He sent me the other day, he sent me signed copies of two of his books. Grizzly Years is one of them. I've been reading this. This is just absolutely incredible. And then he sent me another one, which is about really about his relationship with Edward Abbey. It's called Walking It Off. And you can see he wrote this inscription here. This has to do with the subject that I'm writing about right there. I was very touched. Wow. And he also sent me this postcard with a bear on it. He's just it's extraordinary to talk to him. He just talks in complete sentences everywhere. I mean, he talks like I can only hope to write. I mean, my senses come alive. I mean, just hearing him describe like some scene of Vietnam. I mean, he will describe a cup he was holding and, you know, the texture of the ground he was walking on. I remember him talking about the leaves and trees weeping with Agent Orange on them. It's just a profound experience. I've said to people, if Doug ran a cult, I would join the cult. And then for pleasure, I am reading, it's the last thing I'll say as I ramble on and on here. I am reading a novel called A Time to Be Born, I think it is, by a writer named Dawn Powell, who never achieved any literary fame, apparently, in her own time. It's a comic novel, a kind of satire, Clare Boothe Luce. He was married to the Life magazine, Time Life Impresario, I guess. I don't think I'm using the word impresario correctly, but chief publisher. That's a real hoot. And she can actually, Dawn Powell has a lot of really penetrating psychological insight in that book as well. So I may read more of her after finishing this book.
Clare Boothe Luce, there's the story where she and Dorothy Parker hated each other, you know, this story, and they both came, I think it was Clare Boothe Luce, they both came to the door of some nightclub at the same time, and they, you know, they didn't know what to say, and Clare Boothe Luce said, well, age before beauty, and sort of waved Parker in, and Parker said, and pearls before swine.
Yeah, that's one of her really famous...
It's a good one.
I remember one Dorothy Parkerism, which was, you know, that old saying, you know, brevity is the soul of wit.
Mm-hmm.
Her amendment to that was brevity is the soul of lingerie.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. You know, it's funny that you mentioned the Monkey Wrench Gang, because I'd never heard of that book. And this is the second time today that I've seen it referenced. Somebody posted reading it on Twitter this morning, and then you mentioned it. So I think that's a sign that I have to go get it. I think so.
Yeah, well, I don't know that it's, Doug is one of the main characters in that book. Let me just put it that way. I think he's called Hey Duke. And I mean, it's really funny to me that there are all these people out there that know him that way. And they would love to meet, you know, the legendary Hey Duke, if I've got the name right. But I never read the book, and I know nothing about that. You know, he told me, he wrote me recently that he said, you know, if he comes down to LA to do a talk about bears, which is his big thing, he wants to involve Schwarzenegger. And then he said, you know, he mentioned to me, I already knew it, but he had done this segment for some nature show back in the late 70s with Schwarzenegger. So I had never seen it. I ran off and watched it. It's great, you know. It's like just like a 10-minute segment for some nature show. And by the end of it, you can just see that, it's Doug, not Schwarzenegger, who's the alpha. I mean, Schwarzenegger is just, so happy to be in the company of Doug Peacock. I mean, Doug has blown his mind, you know, as Doug will do.
Yeah.
At the end of my first conversation with him, as you can imagine, I did a lot of the talking. I called him. I had a really hard time getting him to talk to me. He had promised to talk to me, and then I called him one night, and I guess it was rather late for him. And he asked me, the person I was calling him about, he did not know how the guy had died. And it was really painful to lead him through it, because if he died in a really horrific way, and Doug had been close to this person, and he's making all these sort of, you know, gasping sounds, things like that, as I was leading him through what happened. And I said, well, you know, listen, I've got to go, you know, right now, but I want you to know that, you know, you can call again, you know, the phone line is open. And he said to me, you're a good man. And it meant the world to me that to have this guy say that to me, you know, because I mean, I could tell within 2 minutes of talking to him, like, you know, what it was that everybody saw in him. I mean, I had read a little bit of him, but at that point in trying to prepare for the interview, but anyway, this is just turning into a whole interview of me, like, you know, being a Doug Peacock fanboy, but I am one. He's really an extraordinary, extraordinary guy. He writes beautifully. And so, yeah.
I'm excited. I'm going to check this. I'm excited for the new thing that you're writing, as I always am when you're writing stuff.
Well, I'm working on two things. I'm working
That's,
on
I know.
A,
it's like I'm double bonus.
A novel called The X-Rated Book of the Dead. And this other thing is, looks like, I thought it was just going to be an essay, and it looks like it might shape up into, you know, a nonfiction book. And so
that's terrific.
Let's see. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. So are you still on Twitter, or did you leave? You're in and
I
out.
I come and go. I hate social media with a passion.
I know you do. I know. But I want to tell people where to go find you. That's the
I thing. Am on Twitter. I'm on Twitter again. I don't really use it a lot. And I'm unlike Greg, I can't say anything succinctly or wittily enough to get, you know, I mean, I'll have an insight and I'll go, oh, that's good for Twitter. And I'll put it on there. And I mean, I might get like one, you know, like or something, you know. So I just social media, you know, I ironically, I hate Facebook the most. And I finally seem to have learned somehow the secret of how to be liked on Facebook. I mean, I post stuff on there and, you know, I actually got like 130 likes on something I put up. It was an interview with me. I didn't even think it was a particularly good one. I mean, I've done better ones, but for some reason I got 130 likes on this. I mean, isn't it ridiculous? And I'm able to tell you how many likes I got. I mean, I'm embarrassed that I'm even saying that, you know?
That's the key of the thing though. It's just this whole crazy, that's the time that we live in. I was trying to make some sort of joke about 130 grizzly bears, but I can't, it's not coming to me. It's too late in the day.
But that's probably so, all that's left. I mean, Doug is trying to save the grizzly bear. And so, yeah, that's probably all that's left actually in the lower 48. California has a grizzly bag on its flag, and there are no grizzly bears in California. They were all killed. And that's me. That's not, I mean, Doug didn't tell me. He didn't have to tell me that.
Yeah. No, that's just insane. Anyway, again, Duke Caney, got Banned for Life. You got Death Valley Superstars. You've got Subversia. Subversia is also your Twitter handle. So check him out. Go buy his books. You will not be disappointed. Duke, thanks so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.